Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
We have learned about an overarching way of having family and relationships. When I work with me here, I look at the standard way we approach our faith and living out our faith in our Christian life and see if this maybe makes sense. I think we tend to lead by what we believe and what we know. And we say that the Christian life is what we believe and what we know. And so we want to go out and we want to tell people the gospel because we believe that they need Christ. And we want to teach them doctrine because they need to know all about God. And then when it comes to our kids, we want them to know this stuff. But you see, all that stuff's fine. But see, we're telling you that if that's the way you go, you're always going to come up short. Because yes, we believe all the doctrine. Yes, we believe all the truth. But this is more than what we believe. This is about a relationship. This is about a heart connection to the Savior of the world. And that we must lead from the position of our love for Jesus, not just our belief in Jesus. And it's when we go from our beliefs in Jesus to this is how we're going to minister, then we're basically putting people on a performance and on a checklist. Does that make sense? And so that's how we evaluate. When it comes from a relationship, we're driven from our heart connection to God to go out and love other people. We love Him and so forth. For instance, obedience. I can obey Him because I know what He says. And if I do these things, I will gain something from Him. And if I don't do these things, I will lose something from Him. I think that's the way most Christians obey God. I'm saying there's a better way. A grace-based life. It believes all that stuff. It knows all that stuff. But it starts. It doesn't go by. I want to please Him. It starts at I want to trust Him. I want to trust Him. And because I trust Him, I work down through. And guess what? It leads to. It leads to organic obedience. I want my obedience to God coming from my relationship and my love for Him, not just my belief in Him. And when it comes that way, then God can really change everything. So now we've been looking through. We have an overarching plan for God's grace. And it starts with a foundational relationship with Jesus Christ. And His grace comes at us and it meets our driving inner needs. Anybody think they can tell me what the three inner needs are yet? Have you memorized them yet? The first one is?
Secure love.
Second is? Significant purpose. A third is a strong hope. Security, significance, and strength are our driving inner needs. We put those other words with them to show what we're aiming at for a kid. We want to give them a secure love, a significant purpose, a strong hope. And then God also sets our hearts free, not to be to do whatever we want to do, because that's license and lawlessness and anarchy, but to be what He designed us to be. And those freedoms are the freedom to be different, vulnerable, candid, and make mistakes. He gives us those freedoms. Now we turn around and we give them to our children and to our spouse. And then there's these six wonderful character traits, these core muscles that His grace helps us capture in our life. And these helps us when we're afraid or when we're confused or when we're tempted or when we're betrayed. Faith, integrity, poise, discipline, endurance, and courage. And then we looked yesterday at this roof, and we aim our lives not at greatness, because that's all about the world and it's all about me, but true greatness. That's all about God. And we define true greatness as a passionate love for Jesus Christ that shows itself in an unquenchable love and concern for others. So it's an attitude of relationship with God, not just belief in Him, but relationship with His heart that causes me to so love Him that the way we know you are absolutely smitten in love with Jesus is you're always focused outwards. You're always concerned about others. You don't look at what's wrong with them. You see what they need, where they're hurting, and how to draw them up to that. And the four wonderful qualities of this were, anybody remember the first one? A humble heart. Secondly, a grateful heart. Thirdly, a generous heart. And fourthly, a servant's heart. And those four levels with those 17 parts make up an overarching, seamless plan that if that's what God's doing for me, and so all we're saying in grace-based parenting or grace-based marriage is simply treat the people you love the way God treats you. This is how he's dealing with his spouse. This is how he's dealing with his children. This is how he's dealing with you. And let me say, it's more than that. You see, if I have relationship with him, then what has happened to my heart? He has transformed my heart to his heart. And so if the way we know this is innate is that when his heart is so much taken over ours, then we just do this automatically. This just comes out of us. But you see, if I'm only based my thing on what my belief is, where is that? That's right here. It's an intellectual ride. And I'm better than nothing. But it doesn't bring the relationship in. And God is a God of relationship. He made us to have fellowship with us. So with that in mind, how does this look when it comes time to discipline our kids? You don't have any notes on this, but you'll let him cheat off of you. Great. Looking at one another's notes is acceptable. We want to apply. We like to call this everyday grace. In other words, what does this grace relationship we have with Jesus? What the grace he showed for us through salvation? We've now let it define us and wash through us. What does that look like coming out in everyday life? So everyday grace requires us to discipline our kids. The first one there, grace-based parents realize that discipline is a form of grace and follow four simple principles because they realize this is grace. See, a lot of people think, and you can tell when they don't understand grace, because when they come to me and say, I'm very nervous about you're talking about grace, because where are the rules and regulations? As soon as they say it, I know something about them. They don't get biblical grace. They don't get it. Because obviously, God has not ejected the rules and regulations, has he? The rules are all right there. The consequences are all right there in our life. But he never disconnects his heart. You see, you'll never get more or less of God's love based on how you behave. He's guaranteed that. That's the relationship is secure. So we see this as a form of grace. First of all, have as few rules as possible. Have as few rules as possible. Now, what if I'm dealing primarily in what I believe and what my beliefs should cause me how to behave, then I'm going to have a lot more rules. In fact, I'm going to do sin management on my kids all the time. I'm just going to be constantly, that isn't acceptable, that isn't acceptable, get in line. And so you want, but when you have a grace relationship, then you know what matters and what doesn't matter. And because this thing is whole, the whole thing is being driven by love and a great respect and honor with one another, you don't need a lot of rules because they're more inclined to behave anyway. So you have as few rules possible. Then make sure expectation, boundaries, and consequences are clear and consistent. You want to clarify, first of all, the moral reasons behind a biblical standard. We are truth tellers in this family. We do not lie. We do not misrepresent the truth to somebody else. We own our sin. When we do something wrong, we admit it. We confess it. We take our lumps. Those are the biblical rules. But sometimes it's not so much a black and white biblical rule, it's a practical expectation or practical rule. Let's take an example, how your kids keep their room. How many of you have teenagers? Teenagers, okay. Do any of you have a teenager that's kind of a slob? Okay. Okay. So we had four children. Two of them kept their rooms very nice. And two of them, their rooms looked like something exploded in it all the time. Now, there's a reason for this. The two that kept theirs nice, they were from what I would call perfect country. They were hardwired by God. They want to make sure everything is kept neat and orderly and perfect. They needed it that way. Some of you are like that. So you don't have to have anybody get after you to keep your room nice or your desk clean. You just have to do it normally. The other two kids, they were very relational. And they were fun. And they were engaging in people and they were all that stuff, but details didn't matter to them. Okay, so suppose I would have said to them, no, you got to keep this thing perfect and clean. That's disrespectful. We've provided this room. We got these clothes for you. We got this furniture. How dare you? It would have exasperated them. Colossians says, fathers, do not exasperate your children lest they lose heart. So how does grace come to the rescue? Because, you know, they do have to keep, we have to have some order around the house. So what we did, we said, look, every Saturday morning, whether you think it needs it or not, you got to clean up this room. In fact, you got to clean your room, and then we all work together. We clean the house top to bottom. It's Saturday. We clean it up. So here's the leaf blower, and here's the power washer. Find your room for me. And so they would get it, and they would clean up the room. And they would have more fun cleaning it up and take a whole lot longer than it should have, but they'd get it cleaned up. Now, but and then it would just deteriorate the rest of the week, and we didn't worry about it. We just shut, you know, people say, well, what if somebody came over and looked in there? That's what the doors are for. Shut the door. What if one of my friends came over and looked in there, and they think, what's wrong with you? Why would you let your kids do that? Okay, then here's your problem there. That isn't a friend. That's a liability you let in your house. See, friends wouldn't look at you like that. So that now you see that now you have a new ministry. This person needs help. I wouldn't worry. But now we could call an audible. You remember I talked about football changing the play. If we're going to have company over, we're going to have a big two. Okay, we got to clean up our room beforehand. So that's how we did it. So we didn't exasperate them. And then you know another thing. I think a lot of our kids have far more in their rooms than their rooms are designed to hold. We're very consumptive people, right? And so because there's more in there, it's very easy to mess it up. If they just really come in late and they got to get something, boom, and there's their clothes all over the place. And so the point is that Grace says, I don't worry about, I look at how my kid, he says, train up a child according to his unique inner bent. So I realize these kids are wonderful kids. They're just not about the details. And it's not that they're, by the way, we called them sloth. They're really not sloth. They would prefer order. It's just that it doesn't bother them the way it would somebody that needs order. And so we just did it that way. The military, by the way, works just the opposite. If any of you have been in the military, you know how they make you keep all your stuff nice and neat and your weapon clean and your locker box just perfect and all and your uniform right? Why do they do that? It's because of what you do for a living. You go out and you blow things up, and it's very frightening. It's all disheveled and disorderly. So they say, we want your barracks life to be very neat and orderly because of what we ask you to do. Well, what I'm saying is, with grace, if I look at my kid and if I force them to be very orderly, I actually think that it's setting them up to have struggle out here. You see, God knows that we all need some disorder in our life. And he actually provides a way for us to do that on a regular basis in our dreams. You go to sleep at night and you have these nightmares or you have these things. You think, wow, where did that come from? Man, am I glad that wasn't real life and all that stuff. So he lets it, and nobody got hurt. We were just asleep. We were fine. And so you want to make sure that your kids have an outlet to be disorderly in an area where nobody gets hurt. So the room is a little mess, no problem. We clean it up Saturday, and it's fine. But if I would have forced them to keep that nice, and Darcy and I would have been heavy-handed with them, I think now the disorder could come in area of relationships or behavior or bad habits, things like that. Grace really saves the day. Let's look at the next one. Don't make rules that you're not committed to enforcing. And then especially when you throw in the warning that the consequences break some Newtonian law of physics. Like, if you do that, I'm going to kick you over the into next week. You can't do that. You can't kick anybody through time. You might be able to clear the swing set with them, but, you know. So be careful of the threats you make. Because inconsistency encourages children to push the envelope. And then nagging is what we end up doing to them, and that simply undermines grace and causes bitterness. Someone has described nagging as like being nibbled to death by a duck. And you say, well, you just grow teeth and finish me off. This is driving me nuts. Look at the fourth thing is categorize infractions properly as misdemeanors and felonies and discipline accordingly. As misdemeanors and felonies. See, in our civil system, that's what we do. You double park, it's a misdemeanor. It's a small fine. You go out and rob a bank, that's a felony. That's a major crime. We're going to put you in prison. But you see, if I'm a performance-based Christian parent, if I am measuring my kids by how well they behave and how much they hit all the, what I think these very tight things are, then it's going to, I'm going to see everything as a felony. Because it's going to bother me so much. No, divide them up and discipline accordingly. Then letter B, is that letter B in yours? Grace-based parents correct behavior out of love, not anger, by following some simple steps. First one is going to blow you away. And that is avoid making the infraction personal. In other words, don't take your kids' sin personally. You say, Tim, how could you say such nonsense? Don't take it personally. They lied right at me. They looked me in the eye and did a bold-faced lie and they meant to deceive me. How do you not take it personally? I said, don't take it personally. But it was at me. Don't take it personally. You see, first of all, if I'm on a performance-based basis, you see how I would take it personally. How dare you? Why would you do that to the Lord Jesus after all he did and guilt him and shame him and all that stuff? If I'm on a performance-based basis, that's what I would do. Here's why I say don't take it personally. Why are you surprised that your child would lie to you? Why would that shock you? You gave birth to liars. That's what they do. You gave birth to selfish people. That they act selfish. Just catch them, that's all. They just keep catching them and then give them consequences. When they do that, that's unacceptable. Here's the consequence for misrepresenting the truth or clobbering your sister or whatever, you know. These are the consequences, but I don't take it personally. I'll give you an example. I think we could learn a lot from traffic policemen. Okay, you all have traffic policemen with radar guns, right? Okay, let's say he's out on a road here, and I usually do it miles per hour. I don't know what's a standard back road. What would 45 miles an hour be in kilometers?
About 65.
65, okay, let's say a 65 is the speed limit. And he's out, and he's kind of tucked his motorcycle back behind a tree, and he's back there in a little out the woods so he can see, and here you come, and he looks at it. 90 kilometers. Here's what he doesn't do. He doesn't go, 90 kilometers? What's wrong with these people? And throw the thing down. I put the sign right there. I mean, it was real obvious for crying. And then he kicks over his motorcycle and takes off his helmet and punts the thing through the woods and says, what is wrong with these people? Why do they do this to me? He didn't do any of that. Just gets on a motorcycle, pulls up behind you, put the little light show in your mirror.
Disco lights.
yeah. And then he walks up and he has his hand on something, right? His majesty, his gun, you know, his weapon, right? He comes walking up and says, hey, let me see your license. Let me see your proof of insurance. Let me see your registration proof that you have permission to be driving this car. And he writes a little love note from the local judge. And he says, I know you might think you're innocent. Just sign here that you'll show up for the hearing. And you try and talk her out of it. I've met her. You won't. But you can try. Or you can pay this much money and slow down. Just slow down. See, the rule was clear. It's 45 or 60 or whatever. And the consequences are clear. You're going to get a ticket for this much money. He didn't take it personally. He wasn't shocked that people were speeding. That's why he's out there. He knows they're speeding. Some people are speeding because they're late. Some people are speeding because they're not paying attention. Some people are speeding because they don't care. Doesn't matter to him. Boom, catch him. Here's the consequence. Yes, sir?
Aren't we called to live under grace, not under law?
Huh? Well, I didn't hear.
Aren't we called to live under grace, not under law?
No, but see, that grace does not throw the rules out. The rules are all right there. Great. In fact, it's so gracious when I enforce the rules. Hey, why do we have that speed? Because we kind of know what's safe to come down here. If you go above that, you can put yourself in peril or somebody else. And so it's gracious to discipline them. Now watch this. And let me give you a quick one, and then story from our life. Our son Colt, the two girls in the back, I told you this after the focal the other day. Our son Colt is the youngest. His older brother was off at university, and he graduated from university in December. And he had been using, we had a Jeep Grand Cherokee, a green one, and it had a lot of miles on it. We let him use that, go back and forth to Texas to school. He came home, he had graduated, and what we gave him for his graduation is a car, a nice new car. And we said, that's your graduation. By the way, that's the last car we're ever going to buy you, so enjoy it. So I took the keys to the Jeep, and I handed them to Colt, our son Colt, on Thursday morning. I said, okay, you can use the Jeep for the rest of your high school. I gave them to him on Thursday morning. I took them away from him Thursday night. It was Christmas was just around the corner. Darcy was wrapping gifts. I was upstairs paying some bills on the computer. The kids were all out with their friends. The doorbell rang. Two Phoenix police officers were standing at our front door. Darcy called me down there. I said, yeah, what's going on? I said, do you all own a green Jeep Grand Cherokee? Yeah, what's it been up to? He said, well, apparently some kids were rearranging some people's Christmas decorations in their front yard, and your car was the getaway car. I said, well, I happen to know the driver. Hang on. And I pulled out my phone, and I called up Colt. I said, hey, Colt, two of Phoenix Finest are standing here in front of the house. They're looking for you. You need to get home right now. And we stand there talking with him. And then the one kind of did, and they went down the end of our sidewalk, and they're talking. He came back and said, look, we're going to let you handle this one. I said, no. He'll be here in just a few minutes. He'll be here. No, we're going to let you handle it. Honestly, he'll be here, and then you can take it from there. And he said, look, we've got a lot on our plate. We think you're going to handle this one okay. We'll let you handle it. Said, well, okay, but he'll be here. Anyway, so he got home. They had just left. I said, well, apparently you've been having fun at somebody else's expense, and they called the cops on you, so we're going to have to go over and talk with them and see what's going to happen next. So I got in the car, and I said, now, you know where you were, so let's go. And he drove right to it. It was about a mile from our house. He went up there and went up to the door, and we rapped on the door. And this older couple came up. They were in their 70s, and he was a big barrel-chested man, and she was a little tiny size zero waif of a tiny woman. And they had a screen door there, and I said, hi, my name's Tim Kimmel. And my son was here earlier this evening. He was the one driving that Jeep that was here, that green Jeep. And I stepped to the side. And I looked at Colt, and he's 6'4", big kid. Came walking up, and he leaned down, and he says, my name's Colt Kimmel, and I'm an idiot. And it started from there. So what was the funniest thing? That little gal, that lady, she came out, and she just got, said, I can't believe you would do this. We came to America. They had been Eastern Europeans, and they had came over and got citizenship about 10 years earlier. Said, we love Christmas. We bought this stuff to honor our and bless our neighbors, and you kids were over here, and some of them were running on top of you. You're right, ma'am, and there was no excuse for that, and I take 100% responsibility for that, even though there was like 6 or 8. I take 100% responsibility for it. And I'm very sorry. He was really contrite. And she just tore him up. It was, you fathers would love this. I mean, you're just sitting back thinking, this is too good to be true. The big man was back there. And I said, you call the cops. If you want to get him back here, we're here. We're ready to go. He says, that's okay. We'll fine. He said, well, I'll help you clean everything. He said, it's already back there. Well, I can come over tomorrow and work for you. That's okay. He said, well, listen, I know who did this. I can guarantee you they will never, ever bother you again. And I am so sorry. And so then we went home. I said, give me the keys. You'll see them in a month. And it was over. It was over. I didn't take it personally that my kid was an idiot. I was an idiot when I was a teenager. I did stupid things like that. I was foolish. And he got caught. He had consequences. And then we move on. And you know, now if he'd have tried in any way to say it's not that big of a deal or minimize it or what's the reaction, now that car might have been missing for the rest of his school year, and his phone. But he was contrite, in part. But he'd been brought up in a home where we saw parents own their mistakes right out of the blocks. And so he knew this is how you do it. Anyway, all those things helped. Come on up here, Darcy, and help them on this next section.
Well, we've been talking about bracing truth all week, and that's certainly true with discipline, that they work in tandem. And so the second point is discipline with both the rules and the relationship in mind. And we could probably put truth in the place of rules and grace in the place of relationships. You want that dynamic there. And so it says down there, rules without the relationship can lead to rebellion. Because if you're heavy-handed with your child and they don't feel like you have a heart connection with them, then that's when they want to rebel. That's where bitterness comes in. And then on the other hand, relationship without any rules leads to resentment. Resentment. Kids don't want us to be their best friends. They want us to be their parents. And so if you discipline, or maybe you never discipline because you want to keep their friendship, they're going to not respect you. They're going to resent you because children do need boundaries, and they know that. We need to clarify the infraction and the consequences and then administer the detail. And we talk about reality discipline. It's as simple as, okay, honey, we talked about this before. We told you that if you made this choice, then this would be the consequence. And so now that's going to happen. And so it falls logically in our mind as well as their mind. And never discipline at the height of your anger. I mean, kids can really push your buttons and tick you off and get you heated up. But if we have a tendency to be a little too emotional, and discipline and correction turns into maybe punishment more.
Revenge.
And revenge. Then we need to maybe take a break and say, mm-hmm. I'm going to go into the kitchen for a minute. You sit down here. And I'll be right back, and we'll deal with this. Because we never want to discipline and lose control. And then make the correction swift and memorable enough to detect them from repeating the offense. Remember I told you the story, I think yesterday, of Karis when she acted up at the grocery store. I mean, she wanted her spanking to be over with, so that she knew justice had been served and she could move on and the slate was clean. And so we need to make discipline swift. However, I don't necessarily think that disciplining in public is a good idea because there's a bit of shame and humiliation. So you need to take them out to the car or in another room or just say as soon as we get home. And then memorable enough. You don't want to just, you know, or yell at them a little bit. If you don't want them to do that offense again, you need to make whatever you do memorable enough in their mind so that they think, boy, that wasn't much fun last time I tried this. I don't think I'm going to try it again. And then pray in your own heart that God will use this discipline to develop and protect. And direct that child. I wouldn't say to pray with your child just because they're mad at you, probably because you caught them doing something, but pray in your own heart. And then once the discipline has been administered, then like I say, wipe that slate clean. Don't say, man, this afternoon we were really bad. You know, you really ruined my day. You don't keep bringing it up. Unearthing it. It's over with. Chances are there'll be a whole new thing to deal with in 20 minutes anyway, so you got to give that one up. How many of you were spanked when Are there laws in Europe now that you can't spank your children? In the UK, maybe. Yeah. Well, unfortunately, the world kind of has two extremes that you either, they think you either can't spank at all because you shouldn't physically harm your child, or then there are people that spank too much. And so it's kind of a reaction to that. But spanking is probably the most effective way of getting the attention of a young child, maybe starting at 1.5 to 4 years old or something. And it doesn't have to be terribly hard, or it doesn't have to be a lot of spanks. It just gets their attention. You can't reason with a 2-year-old. You can't tell them why they shouldn't do this and expect them to stop doing it. So there has to be a little bit of discomfort. But there are other ways of disciplining besides spanking. Maybe denial of future wishes. Maybe they have something that they've been looking forward to, and there are some conditions on that, that yeah, we can do this, but these are things that need to happen. If they don't happen, then you say, well, you chose for this future wish not to develop. Maybe isolation. You put them in their room or on the front step or something and just sit there for a while. Maybe more chores. For our children, we use this a lot because, if we kept them busy, they got something productive done. Mm-hmm. And if they whined about their chores, then they usually got another one. But they didn't want extra chores, so perhaps they weren't going to do that again. And sometimes a restitution, maybe they need to pay back something that they broke or consumed, or if they use their sister's blouse and got a stain on it, they're going to have to replace that. Loss of privileges, some natural consequences. I mean, if they forget their homework 4 days in a row, maybe you take it to school the first day, but the next 3 days, you're going to get a bad grade because you just can't remember to put your homework in. And sometimes you do have to bring in the authorities. Like Tim was willing to let the police process Colt if that's what it was going to take to ensure that he never did something like that again. It wasn't necessary, but it could have been necessary. And then we need to make sure that our discipline is age appropriate, because there are certain methods that work better at a certain age. For small children, some of the best ways to get them to stop misbehaving is just distract them, remove them from the situation so that they don't see that vase on the coffee table that you keep saying, don't touch, you either remove the vase or you remove the child. And you should have a few age-appropriate rules that are strictly enforced. Let's say you don't want them to stand up in their high chair, because chances are they will fall head over heels onto the floor. Or you don't want them to keep putting their toys in the toilet, because a plumber is expensive. Mm-hmm. So you have a few rules that they know. They're probably going to get a little SWAT or whatever you're going to do to discipline them. And then for older children, back off the discomfort. I think after 4 or 5, spankings are not always the most effective way to correct a child that's older than that. Occasionally, that might be appropriate, but it can become humiliating mm-hmm. to them. And so, some of those other things, lack of privileges, isolation, and then have fewer rules for them. You're moving them into independence. And then for teenagers, that's when you really should have as few rules as possible, because you're wanting them to make their decisions themselves. What we have to remember is that when they make a poor decision, we have to let the consequences rain on them. We can't bail them out, and we have a tendency to do that in the United States. And that's why we have a lot of kids that are off track there, because mm-hmm. daddy can write a check, or you can make it good with the teacher or the coach, and yet sometimes just letting them suffer, sometimes some very severe consequences can be the best way for them to realize that that was not a good choice. Mm-hmm. There's a verse in Proverbs 29 that says, "A child left to himself disgraces his mother. Discipline your son and he will give you peace. He will bring delight to your soul." And so the misunderstanding that grace is always nice, grace doesn't have boundaries, is really a misunderstanding, because grace and discipline go hand in hand. We love our children too much to let them not learn how to do the right thing.
My when I was 13 years old, a friend of mine and I were bored, and we broke into we jimmied the lock on a summer cottage that had a slot machine in it, and we played it, and we brought our own money to play it, and we played it until it had all of its money back and all of our money. We left. Somebody called the county policeman, and they were waiting out there for us, and they separated us, and they called our fathers. His father was a state policeman, and asked them to send him home, and he would deal with them, because you think, you know, don't embarrass me, image control. My father had him, well, what do you do? Well, we take him down, and we process him. We ask him some questions. You'll come get him, and then he'll go before the judge. And so he said, okay, tell me when to come down. And I was just 13. They're not going to lock me up badly. But what they did is they basically asked me about all these unserved, solved robberies and murders, and where were you when, you know, basically scared me really good. And they held me there for about 2 hours, and then Dad came and got me. And obviously I had some media but he wasn't yelling and screaming at me. He just, well, you're grounded now. We'll see what the judge says, and you'll have these chores. And then I went and appeared before the judge, and he just, you know, he yelled at me a lot and told me what an idiot I was. And then he says, "And I could do this to you, but this is your first offense, so if I never see you again, we'll call it a day." And he never saw me again. I never did anything foolish like that again. I had my punishment at home. Did I embarrass my parents? The answer is yes. Word got around at church. Howard and Winnie Kimmel's son Tim got picked up by the cops this week. I embarrassed them, but they were more concerned that I don't grow up to be a fool. Now, my friend, Bob, he's been in the West Virginia State Penitentiary twice because his father was more concerned about his image than his son learning a lesson. We give birth to sinners. They need to be corrected. It's gracious to follow through on that. Now, with that in mind, let's look at... let's look at this whole thing of strong-willed children. And this is applying everyday grace to these wonderful, compelling kids. An environment of grace is the ideal context for bringing the best out of strong-willed children. Too often, we allow the overwhelming nature of our strong-willed children to rob us of the joy of parenting them. We're just so frustrated with how compelling and overwhelming and how relentless they are, and just takes all the joy out of it. And so I'm going to tell you two things. I'm going to tell you a couple things, but there's two things. If these are all you get, you're going to be way ahead of everybody else on strong-willed children and how to respond to them. And the next one comes right now. And that is, strong-willed children are a gift from God. They're a gift from God. They're not a curse from your parents, although your parents do get a kick out of them. You go, girl, light her up, you know, because they're just saying, you put me through this, now it's your turn, and have fun. They're a gift from God. You are given the privilege of raising a leader, a thinker, an innovator, a pace setter, a bigger-than-life person. That's an honor. To think that this is going to be easy, to raise somebody that might have outlier abilities, and so it's just naive. And so he's giving you this. Now, the biggest obstacle to bringing the best out of strong-willed children is weak-willed parents. Weak-willed parents. You can't be a shrinking violet in this whole thing. I mean, parenting is work, but it's good work. It's noble work. I love the way Neil Postman says it. We are given the privilege of sending a gift to a time we will not see. And God gives us these 18, 20 years to take this raw ore and refine it. And take these diamonds in the rough and turn them into something sparkling and hand them to the future. Then we fade away and they do our funeral with it. But we left behind somebody that can not only make a huge difference, a gift to a time we will not see, but they too can give a gift to the time we will not see. Now, there are several factors that may contribute to the compelling nature of our strong-willed children. One is their unredeemed nature. They haven't come to Christ yet. Their unredeemed nature. And so obviously, they don't have the Holy Spirit inside of them working. And so, and you know, Darcy and I, we said we were different than most people in that we did not tell our, we mentioned this to this group, you know, we didn't ask our kids if they'd like to accept Christ when they were little because we knew they'd say yes. They love us. They want to obey us. They want to, you know, please us. And so we didn't do that. We just said, let's surround them with the gospel and expose the gospel and a Christian life and a grace-filled home and the Bible. And then when the Holy Spirit's ready, he will make us move. So why would we think that we need to push this for a strong... Just wait when he's ready. He'll get them. So we must be patient and consistent with them as they decide to turn their life over to God. And frankly, I find myself much more patient with lost people when I see their goofy lives and the dumb choice they make. I think, well, they're lost. What do you expect? I don't correct a lost person's language. If you're lost, that's how you talk. Why would I be shocked at that or surprised or whatever? I don't worry about that stuff. And so in the same way, I shouldn't be surprised. Now, we might have standards in our home and we correct our children. Now look at this. Number two, a lack of structure and clearly defined boundaries in your life often really complicate a strong-willed child's life. A lack of clearly defined structure and boundaries. For instance, inconsistent rules and consequences. I'm going to write it out. Do you have these in there?
Yes,
good, good, good. Cluttered schedule, too busy, too hurried. Remember, Satan doesn't want to make us bad. He just wants to make us too busy. He can steal our joy. He can wreak havoc on us. Or a lack of time with mom and dad because either we're too busy, we're over schedule, we're working all the time, we're too tired, and we just don't get, they need collective time with us, they need individual time with us. Remember what I said? Two best times to touch their lives? First thing in the morning, last thing at night. If you're part of their opening, getting up in the morning with blessing and their ritual of bedtime, you can do huge things with their lives there. Overstimulation, they're watching too much television, they're on their phone too much, they're on their computer too much, they're playing video games too much. These things all have their place in balance. And the strong-willed kids can get overstimulated. Obviously, not eating the right kind of food, too much junk food, not enough sleep. I think that is a pandemic problem among our young people. They just don't get enough sleep. Or a marriage in disarray. And marriages go through seasons, don't they? I mean, we get married in springtime of our love. We hope we live in that hot summer love, but the fact is we have some autumn seasons in our marriage. We have some winter seasons in our marriage. We need to constantly work on maintaining our marriage. And when it gets south, we shouldn't be surprised that this causes havoc among our kids, especially our strong-willed kids. And then a performance-based parenting. When we're putting superficial standards on our kids that satisfy our egos but don't necessarily make any difference, like putting a lot of emphasis on grades at school and performance there, and using these superficial things as the primary standards of measuring whether we think our kid is a good kid, therefore our kid feels our appreciation, our love for them, and somehow is connected to their behavior. Is God's love for us connected to our behavior? And the answer is no. And so why should our kids ever wonder whether our love for them is connected to their behavior, right or good behavior or bad? And yet they do feel that way. In fact, I think this is why, this whole conflict here is why some parents drink too much. Maybe you've heard this. Let me share this with you. A father passing by his son's bedroom was astonished to see that his bed was nicely made and everything was picked up. Then he saw an envelope propped up prominently on the pillow that was addressed to Dad. And with his worst premonitions, he opened the envelope with trembling hands and read the letter, "Dear Dad, it is with great sorrow that I'm writing you. I had to elope with my new girlfriend because I wanted to avoid a scene with Mom and you. I've been finding real passion with Stacy, and she's so nice, but I knew you would not approve of her because of all of her piercings, tattoos, tight motorcycle clothes, and the fact that she's much older than I am. But it's not just the passion, Dad. She's pregnant. Stacy said that we'll be very happy. She has a lean-to out in the woods with has a stack of firewood for the whole winter. We share a dream of having many more children. She's opened my eyes to the fact that marijuana doesn't really hurt anyone. Don't worry, Dad, I'm 15. I know how to take care of myself. Someday, I'm sure that we'll be back to visit you so you can get to know your grandchildren. Love, your son, John. P.S. Dad, none of the above is true. I'm over at Tommy's house. Just had to remind you that there are worse things in life than the report card that's in my center desk drawer. I love you. Call me when it's safe to come home. Performance. When we sometimes put that in, and you see, some of our kids, they're going to work hard to make C's. Do you all do ABCD? Do you do that, or how do you measure here? One, two, three. Is one the top?
No, one is the lowest.
One is the bottom, and five is the top?
Yes.
Whatever the top one is, if that's what we want, your kids may be right in the mid-range, and they work very hard to get them. Yeah. And that they should be in a home where we're excited about that. If A students at the top of the line, B students next one down, C students, don't get buffaloed by what the world says, because here's reality. A students tend to teach B students how to work for C students. When you look at the biggest entrepreneurs in the world, they tended to be average academically because they had to work very hard to get there. So they're very innovative. So be careful putting putting so much emphasis on grades. And then how about learning difficulties? Let's look at these. Different learning styles are often misinterpreted as a disorder, and strong-willed children are often labeled quickly on this. Be careful here. Don't allow a diagnosis to become a label that shames your child or becomes an excuse for them not to work hard. Don't let a label. A diagnosis become a label, you know, like the Scarlet Letter or whatever, if you've ever read that book. And I want to say something here. Realize that many so-called learning disorders are actually incredible gifts that your child has been given. Now, this is, by the way, very counterintuitive to what you normally hear. But we can back it up. We can back it up with numbers. We can back it up with studies. And there are other people sharing the same point. And obviously, I have a position to speak from because I am ADD off of the charts. They didn't know what to call it when I was a little kid. They just said, sit down, shut up, and focus, please, for crying out loud. You're driving me nuts. and it was difficult to do that. So I have ADHD off the charts, and I thank God for it. I am so grateful for it. This is an extraordinary gift. And I didn't build up my parents' ego when I brought home my report cards. They saw B's and C's. Every once in a while, a D. So I struggled in school. But it's a gift. You know what they say about, how can you say it's a gift? You can't pay attention. See, that's hogwash. That's a complete misnomer of it all. It's not that we don't pay attention. It's that we pay attention to everything. That's why we can't focus on what's in front of us. We're on to everything, which makes us great fighter pilots, CEOs, inventors, artists, musicians, visionaries. That's what they become. You think, so if you have a strong little child, do you realize what a gift God has given you? And if they have ADD, Look at that. Now, can it cause trouble? And sure, I mean, you know, I'm forgetful. I can't see things. I get disoriented. I have to have a ritual that I have to make sure I've got everything I need to, before I go. I struggle at that, and I still struggle. And then on top of that, I'm dyslexic. So math, I would be saying the letter seven. I know the number here is seven. I've got the math problem. I got it right. It's a seven. I come back X on it. What's wrong? I'd written a nine. Or I know it's a three, and I'm saying it out loud, three, three, three. I get back, I've written an eight. So I had that problem. I read slowly. But I read all the time. It's just, you figure out how to work it. And it's not a handicap. It's simply a one side of an extraordinary gift, the underside of an extraordinary gift. I'll tell you something else. ADD people, we can hyper-focus. Hyper-focus, meaning we can lock in on when it's something we have to do and we want to do it, we can lock in on it like a surface-to-air missile and stay right on it when everybody else is long since gone. So it's a gift. Now, here's some things that will help your ADHD kids make lists. Have them make lists. They really respond well. Deadlines. They respond well to deadlines. They're not timeliners, they're deadliners. And when they know they have to have it by this time, it works a whole lot better. And have them sit in the front of the class. I was usually invited up there by the third or fourth day of class. Mr. Kimmel, bring your stuff. You're going to be sitting right here for the rest of the time. But it was good because as I'm sitting back there, I had 22 distractions in front of me. And we would just move up there. And then what about medication? For years, I have taken medication. I would make a 6-cup pot of medication first thing in the morning, and then they'd have a 6-cup pot of it for me at the office when I got there. I drank a lot of coffee, a lot of it. That's why I think coffee is the universal medication for ADD. And so you might be, now there's other medications you can take, and by the way, some of them can help, but I would let a neurospecialist make that decision, not just some teacher or some general practitioner, because it's real easy. Many times, I mean, these things work, but just be careful, because many times that we can, you know, what's the problem with a lot of it is sometimes that stuff I said, they're like inconsistent rules and consequences, cluttered schedule, lack of time, overstimulation, junk food, not enough sleep. That's the problem, but parents don't want to fix that, because that's our response. Well, I don't want to fix that. Give them the Ritalin. Give them the Adderall. And so before that, fix this stuff over here. Get some deadlines on them. Help them make lists, things like that. All right, let's close this down here. Some children are strong-willed because God wired them that way. He wanted them that way. And we need to learn how to make this thing into a party. Knowing the unique makeup of your child's strengths helps a parent accept and appreciate the way God made them. Now, I said there were two things that if you knew these things, you'd be way ahead of the game. What was the first one? Strong-willed children are a gift from God. Here's the second one. Strong-willed children want some say in what's going on in their life. They want some say. Now, as parents, we must not surrender our authority. We're the parents, while at the same time allowing our kids to make some choices. Because a parent's job is to keep our children under control, not to control them. Does God control us? Think about it. Does he? He could. He's God. But does he? No. He keeps us free, but he wants to keep us under control with his rules and his boundaries and so forth. Now, so if you have a strong-willed kid, he wants some say. Let me give you two examples. Child wants to, your two-year-old, you want him to take a nap. He doesn't want to take a nap. I don't want to take a nap. Well, son, mom says, it's non-negotiable. We're going out late tonight. If you don't take a nap, you're going to be a nightmare. You got to take a nap. All right. I'll take a nap, but I'm not going to sleep in my room. I want to sleep in sister's bed. I'm not going to take off my pants and put on my pajamas. I know you say I sleep better, but I don't want to do that. And I'm not going to cover up with grandmother's Afghan. I could care less how much love she weaved into that thing. I hate it. Okay, now he's just thrown out three pieces of bait. And he wants to see how many you're going to hit. And many moms, we wouldn't have gotten you a bed if we didn't expect you to take your nap. You're taking your pants off and putting on your bed. And don't talk about my mother that way. How long does he want this to go on? Duration? You wanted him to sleep. Okay, now step back. Let's put some grace on. What is it you want the kid to do?
Sleep.
Take a nap. You have the authority. He's taking a nap. He just wants some say over the conditions. Who cares where he sleeps? Who cares what he does with his pants? Who cares what he covers up with? He's taking a nap. I have the authority. You're doing it. He wants some say. I shared this at a thing, and a lady sent me an email named Cynthia. I just had to send a thank you note while my 2-year-old daughter sat out in a recliner in her room. I have to say, the best example was about letting a strong-willed child make choice at nap time. I used to stay in my girl's room for over an hour, making her stay in her bed and go to sleep. Now I just read her Bible, sing a song, say, night-night, take your nap, leave the room. She either lies on the floor behind the chair or in the corner or pulls a blanket to the floor to sleep on or curls up in the chair, but she's always asleep within minutes with no fussing and sleeps for 2 hours. It's amazing. So much for my idea of making her lie still. So thank you for the wonderful conference and the great rest we're all getting now. It's just grace. God made them strong and compelling. They want some say. Last one. You're out to family restaurant with your strong-willed child. They come to take the orders. And he's been looking at that menu, and there's the number 5 in there looks really good. And the guy says, he comes around to him. He says, I want this number 5 right here. And mom looks at, oh, no, you're not going to have that. You won't like that. Bring him a hamburger and some French fries and a glass of milk. And do not write that down on your thing. Don't write what she just said. I'm here. Put on my seat. Number 5. 5 is what I want. Son, you're not going to like it. How do you know I won't like it? It looks great. No, bring him a hamburger, French fries, and a glass of milk. The food comes. He's not eating his food. Mom says, come on, son. Eat your dinner. I didn't order this. You did. You eat it. I want a number 5. Dad hasn't spoken up yet, but he's about to say the dumbest thing he could say. We're not leaving until you eat that. Well, everybody get comfortable. We're going to be here a while. And then it becomes an ugly scene. Okay, let's step back. Let's step back and put some grace in this thing. What did you want the kid to do? You just eat. By the way, you're at a restaurant with menus. That's the whole point of it. He just wants some say. By the way, this at home, it's whatever you fix. This isn't a restaurant. I don't like this. Well, breakfast is tomorrow morning at 7:15. That's the next time we get a feeding around here. This is it. Well, I don't like it. Well, okay, you can join in the conversation. But this is all the only option. Now, we're not short order cooks at home, but this is, you see how it works? Okay, let's spend some time talking about this for a break. What do you think about applied grace and discipline? Strong-willed children.
But actually, what it really is, it's not focusing on punishment, it focuses on future good decisions.
When my friend and I went into that house and played the slot machine and got caught, my father wasn't looking at the moment and at the foolishness of all that. I mean, he just assumed, he's a teenage idiot. He's a fool. I just don't want him to grow up to be that. I've got enough. I got a few years. I got to make sure that we use this moment to make sure that he doesn't make this a habit. See, discipline is another way I like to think of it is confinement that you put around a child's strengths and weaknesses in order to maximize their potential. And so when we discipline a river, what do we make? We make a dam, we put some turbines in there, and we light up a city. So that's what the discipline, the confinement. But rivers without boundaries are swamps, and they stink. And so that's why we have to have these things, and it's a very gracious thing. But I love the way you're seeing the connection between heart relationship. Remember we said the primary role of a parent is to connect to the heart of the child in such a way that we condition that child's heart to have a heart for God. And so if we treat them the way God treats us, graciously, kindly, mercifully, with forgiveness, at the same time keeping all the boundaries in there and disciplining and correcting when they need to, when they need it, but they never wonder, did I just put my relationship with dad or mom in jeopardy? No, you can't do that. Because I'm not loving you based on how you behave or what you know or how you make me look. That's how God treats us. What other observations?
I heard one saying, if your child will not see God in you, he will not see God as his father.
Mm-hmm. But see, what if I'm just coming in from the doctrine and the truth and the behavior? Then he sees God more as a heavy hand, a person that is easily disappointed and let down by their behavior, a person that, you know, someone in their life that they could lose they could lose affection for him. Have you heard this one? It's kind of like we're like God with skin on, you know, a God that can be touched. And I do think that's the role that God gives us. That's a good one. Yes, ma'am.
I'm curious, like, it happens with my son. So I try to discipline him, and I tell him. And so if he hits me, like, he's angry, and he hits me, and then I say, that's not good, you need to ask forgiveness. And one day he did something, I was frustrated, and I yelled at him, and then he came at me. And, I mean, I realized that it wasn't right what I did. It just snapped. Mm-hmm. And he came at me and said, that's okay, Mommy. I forgive you. And maybe you can take a timeout or a spank.
Talk about kids hitting us or kicking us. Somebody asked me, could your kids ever do that? The answer is sure. Once. Don't see the first one come, but they have never, ever, ever attempt a second one. Because you got to respond fast. By the way, I love the redirect on a small kid. You know, when they're just being, you think, Dad, this is a good one, but your mom's going to do it too. And I can't demonstrate it because it would be, well, Darcy, I'm going to demonstrate it on you. You're going to be the little kid. You sit down here. And this is something we would do often when our kids are just being just ridiculous or they're whatever. And just, you know, and you're very calm. You just grab them by the arm, up high, real high. Come on. And you just take them down the hall real fast. Yeah. You just take them real fast down the hall, down to their bedroom, say, stay right here. Don't move. I'll come back when I'm ready to deal with you. And you shut the door. And they wet their pants. No, they don't. They don't wet their pants. But they just shoot, boom. And they realize, but it does not hurt them, does not injure them. But it just realized somebody is in charge here. But it was not anger, not screaming at them, not yelling at them, all that stuff. It's just, boom, real quick, redirect. And then the other kids say, whoa, man. And one time I put one of our kids in the car in the garage. Obviously took the keys out and all that stuff. You know, and just, you sit here and wait till us come back in there. Whoa, and he's sitting there. And it's very safe in there. But the point is little kids, you know, they need to know that we're there and we're in charge.
When is the cutoff time?
Okay, when have we gone so far as too far to reverse the damage? And I would say never. Never. God never gives up. But one thing I think sometimes we need to do to come to our kids is come to them and say, hey, I need to ask your forgiveness. I really need to ask your forgiveness. Maybe be specific or whatever. I heard a story of a guy, a boy was leaving for university. And his dad said, hey, I want to meet you for lunch. And so the boy came in there and he said, I heard you got all packed up for university and you're leaving. First thing in the morning, he said, yeah, Dad. And he says, well, you know what? I packed some bags for you, too. And I like to unpack them before you leave. He said, what are you talking about? Said, well, over the years, you know, I know that I put some things that cause bitterness or anger or frustration or whatever. There's open-ended things. And he tried, oh, it's no, and he said, no, son, I did it. And that's what I wanted. And he just asked forgiveness all the way through. Darcy and I did that What's Your Beef Night with our kids for that very reason. We just kind of keep that thing close. No open-ended things there. Our example is everything. What Anna's talking about, what my brother, what's your name? Yeah. What our example is everything. Our kids are watching us. And they're making decisions about how they're going to live their life by how we live our life. With that in mind, it's time for another country song, don't you think? Don't you think Nashville needs to come to the rescue? And this is a cute little song that this guy talks, a dad and a son. Watch them interacting here, and you're going to see how sometimes what we do wrong and what we do right can really make a difference. Impact. Mm-hmm.